Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702 for the curious on 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show, brought to you by Nedbank. Looking at money from every angle leads to better money decisions. See money differently. Nedbank, good evening. Welcome to this Tuesday evening edition of The Money Show. I hope you have electricity wherever you are. If you don't, it'll be on in a couple of hours. We hope, because neither government nor Eskom able to tell us today when we're going to be out of stage four rolling blackouts. They can't be certain either as to what this is going to get any worse or not. And so News 24 reporting today that they're preparing for stages 5 and 6 if more generating units go down. And we don't have a capacity problem. They've got 48,000 megawatts of capacity. It's almost half of it isn't working. That is the disaster. Donovan Goliath is providing some light relief on Twitter this evening. If you'd like to play his game, I'd invite you to do so on 31702, 31567, and I will submit on your behalf to Donovan Goliath his game that he wants to play this evening. We need a little bit of a light touch to this. He wants you to replace one word in a movie title with Eskom. So somebody called Lyndon Crouch has responded, Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Eskom. So you know how it works, okay? Replace one word in a movie title with Eskom. Keep it clean, keep it tidy. Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Eskom is your starting point. If you've got a better one than that, 31702, 31567, as we look at the Steinhoff story tonight, and we'll finish with a light touch. And it's an important one as well, how you deal with your honorifics when it comes to sending emails, WhatsApps and SMSs. How polite do you need to be in the 21st century when it comes to one-on-one communication?
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield. Live. Online. Smartphones. DSTV. And 92.7. And
well, Christopher FM. I will catch up with him in just a moment. He's the former Steinhoff chairman. He's got a dinner at 6:30 he needs to get to, so we'll get to him as soon as we possibly can. Well, Parliament hearing today that the investigation into the Steinhoff fraud, which has fingered former CEO Marcus Huerster and seven other executives, is an advanced stage. The hawks are now poring over Friday's PwC report. Janice Q is a journalist at Bloomberg on the line to us from Cape Town this evening. Janice, did Parliament force the new chief executive, Louis Dupriez, to name names today?
Yes, they did. They compelled the company to give out the names that were related to patterns of communication, which is the way it was phrased in the report on Friday. It was a list of eight.
It was, and so we saw the names of Marcus Huerster, surprise, surprise, being named, and the CFO, Ben Huerster, being named directly. And it puts paid to Marcus Huerster's claim in that SMS that he sent to selected people claiming he'd acted alone. It's now very clear that there was collusion, and there was a group of at least eight people in cahoots in this.
Well, we don't know if all eight of them were in cahoots to the extent that, there might be buckets of even amongst that eight. We might find that these patterns of communication were there, but some were regular communicators and were maybe in the inner circle. And some of those names may actually turn out, once proceedings get underway, to be in a so-called second bucket, if you could classify it that way. So we don't know that detail yet, but definitely, this was a small group of people that were referred to in the summary of the PwC report.
How was the mood at Parliament today? I mean, we've seen various appearances by various people at the Eskom inquiry. Today it was the turn of the current chief executive, and I think the chair was there as well. Was Parliament tolerant, accepting, or quite damning of the company, even though many of the perpetrators, alleged perpetrators, are gone?
They were pretty damning, but one of the elements of today's session is that Parliament's rising tomorrow, and so this is the last sitting that they would have with Steinhoff. They are, still working until May when elections happen, but this was the last opportunity to sit. So they were fairly impatient. I think they were far more condemning of the hawks in the MPA than they were of the company in my take, this time around. They really just said that the hawks were completely uninspiring, And this is even though the Hawks said they're investigating for the theft of sign-off. Details from the two bodies are fairly scant, but I suppose that's to be expected to some degree because they're actually going to be the ones responsible for prosecutions, and so they can't say too much.
Janice Q, thank you. Bloomberg journalist on the line to us from Cape Town. Christo Visser, the former chairman of Steinhoff International, joins us this evening, and he's been watching developments very, very closely. You've made this claim against Steinhoff for 59 billion rand, Christo. You say you had the wool pulled over your eyes, that you went into a deal with Steinhoff in good faith, in which you sold your Pepkor shares to Steinhoff in return for shares in the German-listed company. Are you pursuing this claim further?
Very much so, Bruce, but I just need to remind you that at the time that we served the summons, we wrote a letter to the company saying that we all understand that the company just doesn't have the money to pay me back, but in the interest of all shareholders, all stakeholders, there should be a settlement amongst all creditors, stakeholders, at all. And I'm hoping that this report starts laying the basis for proceeding with such a settlement.
I mean, you are a lawyer by training. The term in Latin, I think, the legal term caveat emptor, buyer beware. In this case, seller beware. There are many people who would say that Christo Visser went into this transaction, a man with many, many years of experience of doing complex deals. You took a risk on Markus Juster, and you, like every other shareholder in Steinhoff, was defrauded. They're not going to get their money. Why should you?
Well, let's start first of all, Bruce. I am by far and away, by a country mile, the largest loser. That is point one. Point two is I will only get back, and I'm still a very large shareholder, so I will only get back what other shareholders get back. But other shareholders were clearly not defrauded the way I was. And to say caveat emptor is fair enough, but then I have to point to all the other people with many more years of experience than I have had, who all invested money, all the banks who threw money at Steinhoff, all the ratings agencies, all the regulators, all the auditors. So, you know, I would like to believe that there's a possibility that I am cleverer than they are, but I think it will be a difficult argument to win.
Have you seen the 3,000-page PwC report, or have you just seen the redacted one that they published on Friday?
I've only seen the redacted version, you know, there was nothing, in my view, surprising. The only thing that I'm happy for a number of reasons, but the one is that people can once and for all understand that this fraud had its origins more than a decade ago, and it wasn't something that happened in the last few years where I happened to be involved with China, and the misfortune to serve as chairman for 14 months. Chairing exactly four board meetings before the bomb went off.
Now, I mean, this fraud, a long-running fraud, and the PwC report tells us that this had been in place for a long time. Critics of the board of Steinhoff will say that the board should be more circumspect, the board should have questioned more, the board should have challenged more. When you go back at those four board meetings and the time that you were the chair of Steinhoff, could you, in retrospect, have done anything any differently from an objective perspective?
Well, all these critics, Bruce, I would like to one day engage in a debate and say to them, now you explain to me exactly what it is that a non-executive board should have done in addition to what they have done. This company had a very sophisticated internal audit function. They had component auditors all over the world. They had Deloitte's at the statutory auditors. They had regulators looking at them. They were dealing with banks. They were dealing with analysts, very, very large and sophisticated investors. How come it took PwC with, I'm told, 100 professionals working on it for 14 months to unravel what had happened? How do you expect a non-executive director to sit down when they meet four or five times a year and say, whoops, but there's something here that I don't agree with? Part of the success of this fraud, if you analyze it, is that it started, it would appear relatively small, and then incrementally there was additions. So nobody ever saw something jump out at them and say, wait a minute, but this figure is suddenly different. It was done in an extremely sophisticated manner over a number of years. So I would like the critics to say, to tell anybody what else the non-executive board members could have done. What would have made them that clever that teams of auditors going over it time after time, they didn't spot it. But a non-executive director has to say, wait a minute, there's something wrong here. On what basis would that happen?
If I was to put you into a padded cell with Marcus Huerta, well, how would the conversation go?
Well, you know, I guess I've said it before, the one question will be, why? Why did you do this? I mean, to what end? Because as far as we've seen to date, there is no evidence that money had been stolen. So what was the reason? Why did you set out on a course that destroyed people's lives?
Would you like a baseball? Would you like a baseball bat in that room at the same time as that conversation happens?
Well, I leave that up to your imagination. I mean, if you were in my position, what would you have done? But you know, I made 3 points when it happened, Bruce, and I made them to you, if I remember correctly. I said the first thing for me to get through this disaster is I don't mourn the loss of money. Number one. Number two, I count my blessings, because if this fraud had continued for another year, I would have lost everything. And number three, I'm not going to become a bitter human being. And I can tell you, the first two I can deal with. The third one is very difficult, not to become very bitter at times to see the destruction that had been caused not only to me, but to many other people who find themselves after years of toiling, working at Steinhoff, to find that they've got absolutely nothing.
Chris Avisa, the former chairman of Steinhoff International. Listening to that, Alexander Reyes, who is the managing partner of international law firm DRRT. What do you make of Chris Avisa's rage at his former business partner, former ally, former colleague, former friend, Marcus Huerta, Alexander?
Well, I would say it's an entrepreneurial risk of somebody getting in business with Huerta to see everything destroyed or losing a lot of money. But I'm coming from the side of the shareholders, who everybody seems to ignore, the shareholders who have lost the most money with having the least to gain, with having the least influence and the least information along the way, believing in what was told to them publicly, while the insiders, the directors, and also the auditors had much more access to information and should have implemented a much better corporate governance to make sure things like this don't happen. It's always easy to say that I didn't know, it's not my fault, somebody should tell me what I should have done better. We've heard it with the Enrons and the many other frauds around the world. This is not a new thing. But it's not so easy to say, I didn't have knowledge of it. The question is, what could have been done better, should have been done better? Did you enable a very convincing and smart and mischievous Jooste to actually come through with his plan? Should you have kept a little more control within the board? Should you have distributed the control within the company more, as opposed to just, in quote, rubber stamping what the strong CEO is proposing?
Sorry to rush you, Alexander, but is the breakup and fire sale of Steinhoff inevitable in your view? Because in the same way as Christo Wiese says he's prepared to negotiate and is prepared to compromise on his initial 59 billion rand claim, you're looking for compensation for shareholder losses of 12 billion euros, which is many times more than Christo Wiese is looking for. That value certainly doesn't exist in the share price of the business. It may be some value in the underlying assets. Are we prepared to break it up and sell it off?
Well, of course, the question, it's very simple. There's a limited amount of money, assets, and values to be given to people for compensation purposes, and nobody will be happy at the end, right? Because there's just not 100% of compensation available. But there's directors and officers insurance, there's the errors and omissions or other liability insurance of the auditors. There's money there and there's assets there, and I think everybody has to take a big cut on what they economically lost. I'm not saying that Mr. Wiese did not lose a big part of his wealth, but he can still live well. There are people there who cannot pay for their houses. There's people who were led to believe that this is the local investment that they should put all their pension money in. People are not as sophisticated as Mr. Wiese. You know, something has to be done for them too.
Alexander Royce, thank you. Christo Wiese, thank you. Janice Q, thank you very much. The stand-up saga continues.
Money Show. The markets.
Wayne McCurry is with FNB Wealth and Investments listening in to that. I mean, Steinhoff, is it worth a punt? I don't mean to be flippant about this, but we know that there are lawsuits lining up.
Yes.
We know that there's very little value in the share price. Is it worth buying a share in this thing ever again, Wayne? Was it dead?
And unfortunately, no, Bruce. They are going to be tied up in legal cases. I mean, I'm already an old man, but I think you will be an old man and Steinhoff will still be embroiled in legal cases. It just is going to take, I think a decade would be a short time period to sort this out.
Yeah, and look, it's an unmitigated shambles. There's no doubt about it. I mean, we're sitting with shareholders who are desperate to get money back. Christo Wiese would like to get his money back.
Well, there is no money, Christo's going to be disappointed, and so are, unfortunately, a lot of other shareholders, because there's just effectively nothing left there.
Do you need to cut your losses and move on with your life if you were a Steinhoff shareholder and you've been holding out for 5 cents, 10 cents in the rand?
Yes.
Okay, good advice. Thank you. We can move on from that. Indefinite power constraints, that's a big drag on the overall economy. It's a big drag on South Africa-focused shares. We saw them all falling on their faces.
Yes, and I think that's the reason why. I mean, I'm not too sure what else the minister and Eskom could have said. And fundamentally, it's a politician talking, with the greatest admiration I have for the minister, but he is still fundamentally a politician, so he's never going to really paint the worst possible picture that could happen. He's always going to try and make it look a little bit better, especially before a general election. And as I said, I'm not too sure what else he could have said, to be honest, because I don't think any people know the actual answers now.
Yeah.
But it didn't inspire confidence, and the South African shares and the banks and the retailers in particular came under severe strain. So APSA down 4, MMI down 4, yeah. Nedbank down 3, First Rand down 3, Massmart down 3. Yes.
Surely we have to be considering the worst possible outcome from Moody's. We've got to be now treating seriously the possibility of a full-blown ratings downgrade. Moody's just go, look,
clearly the risk of
energy.
Clearly the risk of that has gone up, but I still think we will escape it this time around. If we don't sort this out in 6 months or a year's time, I think we could very easily go junk. But I think we will scrape it next week. It seems almost inevitable that the outlook will be revised from stable to negative. So
yeah,
a mini downgrade, but not the big one. Look, I mean, I met with management of one of the biggest power users in the country two or three days ago, big smelters, massive smelters. And they obviously deal with Eskom, and they deal with the technical guys, the power station guys. They deal with them every day. And their opinion, for what it's worth, says that we can get to some sort of stability. Now, stability in South Africa is Schedule 1 load shedding. That's stability.
Okay. I'll take Schedule 1. I'll take, oh
in
my goodness,
six months.
That long. That long.
That was their view expressed to me. They did also express that Schedule 4 is truly, truly unusual. And no matter what you might think of Eskom, and no matter what your opinions are of how it's being managed, they were quite emphatic to say that we must not think Stage 4 is normality. They say it is truly abnormal to be at this level of load shedding. But so if that's any positive news, yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, but then you see News 24 saying government is preparing for 5 and 6, and they'd be
well, thank goodness they're preparing for it. Yeah. I hope you don't get it, but at least if we do get it, they're prepared for it, not like the first lot of load shedding we got.
Absolutely. Wayne McCurry, thank you. With FNB Wealth and Investments, deep insight this evening on issues around power supply and the blackouts, the rolling blackouts that some people call load shedding.
The Money Show is brought to you by Nedbank. Looking at money from every angle leads to better money decisions. See money differently. Nedbank.
Well, sorry about the delays. I blame load shedding. I don't know what's caused it, but we got our technical people. I get out from between my legs. Technical people are working on this. He's staying down there far longer than he should. Solutionist Thinking Season 2 underway. This week, the turn of theoretical physicist and Mars volunteer Dr. Adriana Moret. Now, she's a physicist, an innovator, and she's an aspiring extraterrestrial who believes that we're living in a unique point in the history of life on Earth, and she thinks we need, as a matter of urgency, before we get to stage 5 and 6, head off into orbit and find a new planet to inhabit. And as head of innovation at SAP Africa since 2017...
to really unlock the potential of 7 billion plus and counting people.
10 by 2050.
Yeah. Sure, maybe more. So that's really priority number one and also goal number one. Good. Let's assume we've eradicated poverty and everybody has enough food, water, air, data, access to technology, etc. What next? And I think these are similar questions that we're grappling with this whole discussion around the fourth industrial revolution. And I think any technology that we've developed will always think within the framework in which we've developed it.
She's a deep thinker on so many really highbrow things, but communicates magnificently. Dr. Adriana Moret, this week's solutionist thinker. Well, we're busy battling our own disaster right now, trying to get our signals sorted out. And until we do, we continue broadcasting online. We're broadcasting via DSTV. And, of course, in Cape Town, we're live. I think Johannesburg may be struggling to hear us this evening. But Professor Nicola Klein, I don't want to talk about our own problems, which I'm going to blame on Eskom this evening because I haven't got no one else to blame as I sit alone in the studio. Dean and marketing expert at Gibbs. But how is Eskom performing in terms of disaster management and its way of communicating honestly with the South African public, including ourselves tonight, at breaking point? Oh no, Nicola, Earth to Nicola, I can't hear Nicola. I'm told Nicola can hear me. Nicola, Earth to Nicola. No, I'm afraid not. Nicola can't hear us. So now we've wasted her time together this evening as well. One last chance, Nicola. No. Nicola, no. Sorry, Nicola. Apologies for messing you about this evening. It does seem to be as if we are struggling tonight with our tech. Tekiso, do you want to see whether or not you can try Nicola on a different line? Whether or not we can do one more go? Nicola? Earth to Nicola? No, it's not going to happen for us this evening. Professor Nicola Klein, this commitment, this confirmation that neither government nor Eskom able to tell us when we're going to be out of stage 4 rolling blackouts and having a direct impact on what we're trying to do on the radio, which is to try and calm everybody down and try to see whether or not we will be able to get out of this particular issue. And Fin24, News24 today reporting stage 5 and 6 load shedding planning happening, and they would be irresponsible to do anything else. I think it is smart to be communicating that. Tonight we have had in Eyewitness News, of course, the confirmation of Andrew Etzinger at Eskom saying that they have no intention of going to 5 and 6, but then they have no intention of going to stage 4.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield. Live. Online. Smartphones. DSTV. And 92.7. And 106 FM.
It's been all fun and games on the radio this evening, and I really must apologise for whatever has gone wrong. We don't have a clue, frankly. We've got Ben Moon pulling out all sorts of things. Stephen Andrews, no, it's not CR17's SSA spies after us. They may be after us. It would be quite a flattering thing if they were after us. But I think it's far less mysterious than that. And to those of you who had to endure Mariah Carey, I sincerely apologize. I really do. I may share something with you that may make you a little bit smiley this evening, because that's what we need, is a bit of a laugh and a bit of a smile. Earlier on, I said to you, Donovan Goliath, who's a very funny man, he's a great comedian, is Donovan Goliath, asked if you could come up with different ways, movie titles with the word Eskom in them. And so I, on your behalf, while we were playing Mariah Carey, came up with a whole bunch of these different movie titles. The Good, the Bad, and the Eskom was one of them that came through this evening. The Eskom and the Furious. Eskom Infinity Wars. Eskom, the Dark Knight Rises. Lots of you coming through there. Oh, John and Craig Park, not funny. Eskom. Everybody dies. So you've got a sense of humor on you, which is good. I'm delighted that you've got a bit of a sense of humor on you, and you need to have that sense of humor at a time of deep uncertainty in the country, as Eskom, with all the best intention of the world, is trying to resolve these issues. Monty Python's Eskom Circus, 4 weddings and an Eskom. The die hard, die Eskom. 10 things I hate about Eskom. I know what Eskom did last summer. Well, if you know what Eskom did last summer, could you let us know, please? Because they certainly weren't doing any maintenance. Anyway, some of you are good-hearted. Thank you. Just lightening the load a little bit this evening on Loadshed Tuesday. That's the first hour of the Money Show done and dusted. It's Eyewitness News time.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702 for the curious on 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show, brought to you by Nedbank. Looking at money from every angle leads to better money decisions. See money differently, Nedbank. Well, that was an eventful first half hour. If you could have seen what was happening behind the scenes there, you would have been amused. Hopefully you weren't too irritated, and hopefully you haven't abandoned us. And I'm delighted that you are still with us this evening. Andy Rice standing by. We'll do Heroes and Zeros with him. Nicola Klein has sent us a voice note, so we'll try and play that for you as well. Because Nicola was about to make a fantastic contribution on the way in which Eskom has managed its communications. So we'll see whether or not we can download that from my phone and get that onto our systems, provided it doesn't crash the systems once again. All fun and games here in our studios this evening. Andy Rice on the... I can hear Andy Rice. I can't believe it. Earth to Andy. Hello, Andy.
I'm here, Houston.
Oh, thank you. Don't call me Houston. I've got a friend called Houston, and he's a pain in the neck. Now, time to look at political parties. Can we just have a rant about Eskom and its brand promise, Andy Rice? I mean, he has Eskom, which has got one job. It is a monopoly. Its job is to provide, to provide supply and to distribute electricity, something at which it is failing dismally. Does it matter if you are a national country brand and you blow it to the extent Eskom has over recent years?
Yes, it does, because I think Eskom acts as a proxy in many people's eyes for the state of the nation. So potential investors looking at South Africa from abroad will look at a state-owned enterprise that claims to power the nation. I think that's the line they use, clearly failing dismally to do just that. So, yes, I do think it matters. I think, personally, that we should take all the money that was aimed at Eskom and use it to buy individual home generators and hand those out to everyone and then close down Eskom for good.
Andy Rice, thank you for that comment. I just want to play the comment of Nicola Klein, who sent us a WhatsApp just a moment ago. We said to her, is Eskom doing a decent job? She is an expert, of course, in crisis communications. We'll come back to you with Heroes and Zeros in just a moment. But this is the voice of Nicola Klein, who sent us this voice note tonight.
Sorry, we couldn't chat earlier.
Hello, Bruce.
But, a little asynchronous messaging late rather than never, I guess, is better. It's been too little too late with Eskom in terms of communication. It's really good that Minister Gordhan and senior officials of Eskom met the press and spoke today. But really, we needed to hear a lot more about this a lot earlier. We need to see Eskom keeping us in the loop with updates all the time. We need to not see entrepreneurs inventing the best load shedding app. Eskom should be coming out with that. We need to also remember, and we need Eskom, I think, to remind us, without making excuses, that some of this is linked to Cyclone Idai. And whilst load shedding is not a pleasant experience for anyone, and particularly the more vulnerable who may be unsafe and where it's more than an inconvenience, we're talking about tens of thousands of people who are stand to lose so much more than we're losing right now. So it is a perfect storm. Some of this is beyond Eskom's control, but what they really need to be doing is taking back the high ground in terms of communicating. I need to understand, what does load shedding at stage 5 and stage 6 look like? So I implore Eskom to please open up to the South African public, talk to us, show a little bit more empathy, and... Yeah, I was thinking about your movie titles, and I'm going to call it, instead of Tragedy of Man, it's Tragedy of Eskom. My daughter's come up with Let There Be Light, When the Lights Went Out, Lights Out. And the last one, Eskom, we need you to shine a light. Communicate better, please. All the best, Bruce. Bye.
Nicola Klein, thank you. The Dean at Gibbs. I think she hit on a really interesting point there, Andy Rice, when it comes to this. I mean, look, we've got 48,000 megawatts of installed capacity. We've got demand of 28,000. It's not just Cyclone Idai. But certainly Cyclone Idai is a contributor to our load shedding crisis. But we've got to remember that our neighbors, of course, are living through a hellish tragedy right now.
They are indeed, but I also think that you cannot just rely on continuity of supply from neighbours if you're importing electricity from them. Any prudent business would have a contingency plan that says, in the event that, through circumstances beyond our control, we lose that import volume of electricity, we have a plan B to make sure that no one is affected badly. And I think the absence of that is another example of how poorly Eskom have managed this whole thing over many years.
We have, unfortunately, used up our plan A, B, C, D. Then we're somewhere near plan P. Anyway, Andy, let's talk about heroes and zeros. Political parties. I mean, you gave a hero, I think, to the EFF, and I think zeros to both the ANC and the DA, if memory serves.
And to COPE, I think, as well. We must try and get through most of them before May the 8th. And I thought today we could look at two, because there are two brand new parties, two brand new kids on the block. One so new, only was launched over the weekend, just passed. But the first one is Patricia de Lille's, her party called Good. Rather, I suppose, almost too clever name in my view. It makes it quite clumsy to use, but I think they hope that means that they'll just steal a word from the regular vocabulary. But I think it will be a headline maker's delight and a cynic's delight as well. But less than about the name, what about the actual promise that they make? Well, this is one of those very personality-driven parties. It's Patricia de Lille and Patricia de Lille and Patricia de Lille. And if you go onto their website, which is quite comprehensive, I have to say, what it lacks is what all of the parties I think have lacked, which is the summary, the little soundbite that says, here's what we believe in. And maybe they're just relying on the word good to do that for them. But as usual, they have a claimed mission that talks about people who believe in truth, trust, equity, social justice, solidarity, sustainability and service. And you know, I just think that doesn't help anyone work out where they stand in terms of the competitive set of political parties. Their very first element from their plan is fix spatial injustice. Now, if you can tell me what fixing spatial injustice is about, that's good, but I can't.
I do get the worthiness of it, but I mean, in a world of cut and thrust politics, calling yourself good is a high stakes game because you only need one of your members to go bad before it really then does turn around and bite you in the backside, and then all that is good goes bad. The headlines will write themselves on that particular point, and you need to be, without being juvenile about it, you do need to stand for something. If you stand for everything, you're not going to be interpreted as standing for anything, I'm afraid.
Exactly. And I think, you know, another headline that is waiting to be written is going from good to great as soon as someone else finds the opportunity to trump, if that's not a bad word, for sure.
Not in this context.
The area they will look in. I think it's, you know what actually I think is the biggest disappointment about good is that they were launched, what, correct me if I'm wrong, 6 to 8 weeks ago, I'm guessing, maybe even a bit more. They only had this finite period of the run-up to May the 8th, and they actually haven't used it. We should have had Patricia de Lille everywhere. We should have had good everywhere. We hardly heard a word since the announcement of the formation of the party, and that's no way to win seats at your first election when it's only a few months away.
And these things are expensive and expensive to run, and often you don't get a second chance. Ask Cope. I mean, they've had a couple of chances, but they've squandered those too. Capitalist Party, these are the purple cows, right?
Yes, the purple cow, an emblem both in colour and in animal of wealth. Purple being kind of royal colour, and cows in many parts of this continent being a measure of wealth. And the Capitalist Party is quite interesting because it stands about as far from the other rabble-rousers as you can get in terms of politics, if we understand capitalism correctly. And they're actually saying that capitalism has been a force for good, but has come in for as much criticism as its polar opposite, communism, in recent times. And a quote from their website says, "Here in our beautiful South Africa, politicians have turned capitalism into a swear word. They make us feel guilty for working hard to improve our lives, and this guilt allows us to let them steal money from hardworking families and use the money for corruption." Okay, no punches pulled there. And I think it's an interesting challenge, isn't it, to take a word that in many people's eyes is a swear word and form a party around it. Would you vote for the state capture party, Bruce? I'm not sure you would. But,
well, it depends what's in it for me, really, Andy. Again, you know, we get the rats and mice parties all the time, and these are people who feel very strongly that the capitalist voice needs to be heard. You like moths to a flame, it will draw an interesting gathering of individuals, not all of whom will necessarily fit in with the party principles, perhaps, the noble intentions that the party, the people starting up the party have decided to stand for. And again, they run a high risk of having themselves tarnished very quickly, and they become a sitting duck as a purple cow in an environment that is very anti-capitalist. I mean, you're asking for a fight by calling yourself the Capitalist Party. They could have come up with something a little less immediately easy with which to dispense, perhaps, from the left of their particular persuasion.
Well, I suppose if that's what you believe in, then full marks to them for saying it so directly. I rather like the fact they also say on their website, "No BS," and we'll know what that stands for. Which seems odd when your logo is in fact a purple cow, which is presumably full of BS at various times of the day.
I think they mean no black sheep.
Yes, of course. How silly of me to look at the vulgar interpretation. My apologies.
Are you a fan? Are you a fan of what you see in the Capitalist Party in terms of their positioning? They're very clear what they stand for. But their logo is certainly stand out. It differentiates themselves very well.
Yes, I think, you know, that's one of the great strengths, as we spoke before, about the EFF. There's no denying the visual power of their identity. I rather like the fact that the Capitalist Party launched their party at the Rand Club. I mean, they really are pushing every button that they can.
Yeah.
I suspect they'll be pretty good in terms of being social media savvy. Certainly, at least one of the people in the party that I know is a real expert in the use of social media and other digital platforms to boost a brand. So I think we'll see a lot of them online.
Okay, so do they get a hero this evening?
No, they don't, but good gets to zero. I think that it's too early to tell for the Capitalist Party. I think it's brave and interesting, but we'll have to see whether they get more than the limited number of people who've signed up so far. But I do think good have failed quite dismally to use that window of opportunity to take a really quite media-friendly person in Patricia de Lille and really exploit that opportunity. They've missed the boat, I think.
They missed the opportunity there. What about a hero? Have we got a hero? Do you dare to find a hero in a country that's in a zero kind of mood?
Well, moving away from the political parties, my hero is about an ad which sometimes you just have to like a piece of communication. You don't need to be persuaded by all sorts of facts and figures and weigh it all up in your head. Sometimes you just see a piece of advertising that you like. It makes you smile. And subconsciously, it really does get that brand into your system.
I want to play the soundtrack from it, Andy. I mean, these are two guys. These are techies. They're at the Meerkat Space Telescope. They're surrounded by satellite dishes, by enormous satellite dishes in the middle of the Karoo. Something has gone wrong, and this is what it sounds like.
Chucky, pass me that dingus. Chucky!
Sorry, Donnie, which dingus?
That dingus, man.
Is it now the dingus dingus or the dingus dingus?
The dingus dingus. Others?
And then they start playing with the toys and they start messing around with the satellite dishes and they start behaving like children, as grown men will do when given access, unbridled access to technology. And it is just lovely. I mean, it is, as a piece of communication, it is quintessentially South African. It's showing off the high-tech nature of the Meerkat Space Telescope. But the thing is, it's all just about the joke and our colloquialisms with each other.
Well, absolutely. This is for the Kia K2 Bucky, or light truck, I suppose. And the brief to the agency, Old Friends, Young Talent, was to come up with a scenario and a creative idea that stressed the way in which the vehicle in question fits in so well with the local landscape. Many times, local distributors of vehicles that are built abroad have to run with advertising that was created abroad, and usually it's not as appropriate as it might be. But here we have an example where the company has allowed the agency to do something local, and I just think it doesn't make you think too much about load boxes and overhead camshafts. It just puts a smile on your face, and right now that's not such a bad thing in my eyes.
Thank you for giving us a little smile. Andy Rice, our branding and advertising expert. Andy Rice this evening, full go at Eskom. Zeros for the Good Party, the Capitalist Party, the ZACP Party. Lack of legacy, help or hindrance. I mean, it's just, yeah, complicated stuff starting a brand new brand. But the hero, the Dungus advert for the Bucky, the Kia. Was it Kia Bucky? The K2700, I think. And we're struggling to find heroes at the moment. Andy Rice, however, can be relied upon to do precisely that.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield. Live. Online. Smartphones. DSTV.
And 92.7. FM. Business Report. I must just tell you about R&B Solutionist Thinking for the creative minds with a passion for possibility. Just in case you missed it in the lost half hour of The Money Show this evening, as we struggled against the load shedding gremlins. Adriana Marais is our solutionist thinker this week, and she's quite an extraordinary individual. She is a rocket scientist, literally. She is a theoretical physicist. She is a scientist. She's a PhD in something incredibly complicated. But she is unique in that she is one of the very few people in the world who is prepared to put everything on Earth behind her. And she will volunteer for the first Mars mission that comes her way. And she's deadly serious about giving up everything that she has on Earth to go and set up a colony on Mars. Please listen to the extraordinary story of Dr. Adriana Marais, this week's Solutionist Thinker, Season 2. Of the Solutionist Thinking podcast series.
The Africa Business Report.
And on to Lee Kasumba, who joins us now, the host of Africa State of Mind podcast. And Lee is with us tonight on The Money Show. We've got a natural disaster on our doorstep. Hundreds, possibly more than 1,000 people killed in Mozambique. And beyond the loss of Cahora-Bassa power supply to South Africa and the consequential load shedding that we have here, is it too early to estimate the disastrous consequences of Cyclone Idai on Mozambique, Lee?
Good evening, Bruce. What is really scary is that prior to Cyclone Idai hitting Mozambique and Malawi, the president of Malawi estimated, and because they had heavy rains last week, both countries, they estimated that for Malawi, it was going to cost about $16.4 million to rebuild, and Mozambique was looking at about $18 million. And I have to emphasize, this is before the cyclone hit on the weekend. So those new numbers are still to be tallied up. But I'm not so sure it's looking so good. In Mozambique, for example, one of the biggest hit areas is Beira. If you remember Africa Connected last year, we went there. And the port of Beira, literally that entire city, which has about 500,000 people, according to UN agencies, every person was affected. Every single building was affected. There was damage to all the buildings, which is really intense. There's no power. There's no telecommunications. There's no electricity. The president has not even been able to land there. He literally had to take a chopper to fly over Beira, and a lot of the roads going into other cities from Beira have pretty much been blocked off by the flooding. So that is devastating for the country, and it's going to be, it's going to take a lot of help to be able to rebuild Malawi and Mozambique, and then also the parts of Zimbabwe that have been hit as well by Cyclone Idai.
The individual impact is just so huge. Let's skip ahead to Zimbabwe and doing something that is long overdue in Zimbabwe, already long overdue in South Africa, and this decision to sell shares in state-owned entities. I mean, I don't know who would invest in these state-owned entities. I'm not sure what's investable in the state-owned entities. Mm. But finally, though, Zimbabwe, they're waking up to the reality that they can't do this thing alone.
President Mnangagwa has had a huge problem taking on after President Mugabe, because obviously there's been a lot of, the economy has been hit really hard. So what the finance minister said in a statement, he started talking about it in October last year, and then they confirmed it this month. They're going to sell shares in 5 state-owned entities. So they're 2 mobile phone operators, NetOne and Telecel Zimbabwe, as well as the country's sole fixed telephony company, Tel One, and then the postal services and a state-owned bank. And so what they're hoping to be able to make from this is around $350 million, because outside of the flood, outside of the cyclone that has hit parts of Zimbabwe at the moment, prior to that, from about November last year going into this year, there was a huge drought in Zimbabwe. And according to the UN humanitarian agency, about 5.3 million people were in need of food. So Zimbabwe is literally in a crisis. We've discussed the dollar crunch. We've discussed the lack of fuel and all of that. So it's really culminating. So right now, it looks like the only way that they can get out of this situation is by selling shares in state-owned companies. And in addition to that, there were also 43 companies that they consistently have to bail out. I think we're used to that in South Africa, are also up for sales, just as a way of ensuring that, you know, that they are able to get money into the economy in Zimbabwe.
Lee Kasumba, thank you, the host of Africa State of Mind podcast. Lee Kasumba this evening. Yeah, lessons for South Africa to do it while there's still value in the assets worth saving, and you don't have to do a Zimbabwe-style fire sale.
The Money Show is brought to you by Nedbank. Looking at money from every angle leads to better money decisions. See money differently. Nedbank.
Welcome to The Money Show this evening. Mandy Collins in studio with us this evening. She is a writer. She's a business writing trainer. And she is a stickler for good manners. You are, aren't you? I mean, certainly in public.
Yes, definitely in public.
Okay, so tonight's How It Works feature is digital communication etiquette. And I ask this question as somebody who remembers phoning someone. And you don't have to introduce yourself anymore when you phone someone. Chances are the person you're calling knows who you are because you're phoning a specific number and you're getting the person you intend. And the odds are they've got your number and they just pick up and go, hello. And you have a conversation because you've done the introductions digitally already. You remember the days, I'm sure, of phoning someone you fancied and their mother or their father answered. And you've got the dry mouth, and you'd have to deliver pleasantries first in order to sort of get through the gatekeeper to speak to the person you really wanted to talk to. Nowadays, you phone them directly. directly on their device, or you contact them by any number of platforms. When you used to write a letter, you remember letters? There used to be a place called the post office that used to deliver these things. You'd write them with a pen. Okay, now we're going to explain what a pen is. A pen is one of these things. In your day, it may have been a quill, Mandy.
Thanks.
And you'd write a letter, and you would then sign the letter, and you put your name at the bottom. It was, you'd either go yours faithfully, or yours sincerely, or yours, or you go love, or lots of love, depending on who you were writing to. And we've seemed, I think, Mandy, to have taken many of those sort of pleasantries and formalities forward into the digital age, haven't we?
Well, we have and we haven't, and where we have taken them forward, I think often done it badly. I offer you the prime example of, I hope this email finds you well. Because, you know, the email leaps out of your little computer and goes searching around for you with a big magnifying glass and a stethoscope to check whether you're well or not. It's the most ludicrous expression I've ever come across.
You have the same allergy to public relations practitioners of a certain ilk.
Yes.
Who determined to drive us completely mad, personally, by wishing, I hope this email finds you well. Firstly, the email has not found me. It has arrived in a digital box, and it has no emotion and no care. I once replied to a public relations practitioner who should have known better with, this email doesn't care about my feelings. And they had the good grace to apologize.
Well, I could do you one worse, if you like.
Oh, please go on, drive.
I once got an email from a PR practitioner who I'd never met, never had any contact from, etc., etc., that started with, hey, babe. So that's taking pleasantries to the wrong extreme.
Yeah, I might warm to that, but that's just middle age. I want to get to that sort of extreme communication. But just in our everyday lives, are we expected in an email to say, dear Mandy, here are the 10 things we need to talk about, regards, love,
farewell. Oh, Bruce, if you were writing to me, cheers, I would hope, Bruce, you would say, dear Mandy. But no, look, I think with all writing, whether you're writing an email, whether you're sending a WhatsApp, whatever you're doing, when you're talking about the professional setting, what you want to do is start at the end. This is what good writers know. We think about who is receiving this communication. And then we think about what tone we want to adopt. And in business, it's a bit like going to a cocktail party where you're not quite sure of the dress sense. You always overdress rather than underdress. So I think the key is to think about, who am I writing to? What is my relationship with them? What tone can I take here that will still be professional? And if I'm writing particularly externally to clients outside of the company, would I be comfortable putting this email on the company letterhead?
Good. That's a good test, actually. That is a good test.
You know, we forget that digital stuff doesn't die. And when it's unearthed, you want it to look good.
This is true. If there's ever an audit, and if there's ever a trail that is required, how did your communication come across?
Exactly.
Was it deferential? Was it respectful? Or was it frivolous and silly? How would the person on the other end of this communication have interpreted your communication? Did your communication contribute to enhancing the relationship that your corporate entity had with the other corporate entity, or did it undermine in any way? And suddenly you get yourself into an absolute blooming minefield, don't you?
Yeah, and I think it's really, you know, people either go to one extreme or the other. Either they're writing as if they're wearing their cap backwards and, I don't know, on a skateboard, or they are writing as if they're sort of, you know, an advocate in the high court. And I think we need to aim for a tone that is professional, but everyday sort of conversational words, if I can put it that way.
So email is less formal than letter writing,
yes,
but needs to convey the same tone as a letter might have done 20 years ago.
Yeah, and I think that tone is always professional, not formal, if I can distinguish between the two.
I dare you to try.
So, you know, formal is the... please find attached here too for your kind information.
Oh, I get emails like those.
Yes, yes. They look like they're written by Barry Roux. And really, I mean, we all know how to find an attachment these days. We don't go searching around our emails for the attachments. We know where they are. You can just say, here is the attachment you asked for. That's perfectly professional. You don't have to get into the convoluted here too, after, under, which. It's ridiculous.
I mean, who outside of a law class has ever been taught that kind of language?
I don't know. And frankly, they shouldn't be teaching it in law classes either. It's complete nonsense.
It is. And so your basic lesson when it comes to communication is to use short, simple words in short, simple sentences that are clear and to the point.
Yeah, because we forget that we live in a country where there are 11 official languages and only 10% of the population speaks English as their first language. And yet it's the language of business. And we also work in a global village where you have Indian English and Australian English and South African English and American English, and they're also different as well. So the more simple and plain you can be, the less likely that your words are misconstrued.
What is the obsession? And I think it comes from people who feel insecure about their mastery of the language, mm-hmm. who then overdo it. And in overdoing it, you expose yourself to being insecure about your use of language.
Exactly.
Rather than having the confidence to say, the sky is blue, it is a beautiful day, I hope you have a good trip.
Yep, and that's the whole message of the plain language movement. It's a very common feature with second language speakers, no matter which second language they are communicating in. So if we're using English as an example, it's a kind of a, I feel insecure about my English, so now I'm going to demonstrate just how good I am and use the biggest words that I can. And the problem with doing that is that if you are not a first language speaker, you lose the sort of idiom, you lose the connotation rather than the denotation. And an English speaker, there are subtleties that a second language English speaker would not necessarily pick up. And if I were to try and communicate in isiZulu, for example, with my very broken isiZulu, I would make the same mistakes. It's a hallmark of second language writing or speaking. So it's just about having the confidence actually to hold back a little and to speak to people when you're writing, because it's just speaking on a page. Speak to people when you're writing the way you would speak to them across a desk. You know, you wouldn't arrive back from buying the groceries for your significant other with a packet and say, attached here too for your kind information, the loaf of bread that I just purchased. You'd say, here's the bread. So we need to just try and write on the page the way we speak.
Thank you for putting it so clearly. Here is the bread, dear. People also, the moment people are confronted with the pen and paper or confronted with the keyboard, they feel this immediate need to formalize. And there is no need to formalize.
Yeah, because they think it's writing with a capital W. And really, if you can't, you just need to speak onto the page. And if you are struggling, chances are you haven't formulated your thoughts properly. Because you can't write well if you haven't thought well first, I think.
Okay, so we've got through the hurdles of the letter, and we've got through the hurdles of that sort of communication. Understand that this your email could very well be recalled. I had a conversation with a public relations practitioner who I know very well from many years ago. I hope that one never comes to light. It was quite personal. How soon should one respond to an email? There are people who are very good at managing this sort of thing. I'm not in that group of people, where they close their inbox and they visit their email inbox two or three times a day, and they set aside half an hour per time, and they go through their emails, deal with them, and then shut down their email inbox again, and then get stuck in and focus on another couple of hours' work before going back. Most of us wait for the ping so that we can reply faster than, you know, we can read the mail.
So I see two things happening. I either see people doing exactly that, jumping on that ping and answering immediately, and then often answering badly or without proper thought. I've done it myself. You know, you dash off something quickly because you're worried it's an important client or it's somebody who's perhaps got a little power over you, and then you send off the wrong thing. It's all too easy to push send. And then you have the stream. I have people that we've sent emails to at least a week ago, and it's like they've fallen into a black hole and have never been seen again, either the people or the emails. I'm not sure which. So I think we need to aim. Look, internationally accepted sort of general guideline is within 24 hours. Obviously, if it's urgent life and death situation, which I very much doubt they're going to deal with via email, you can answer sooner than that. But I think 24 hours is reasonable, and that gives you time to actually respond thoughtfully. And responding thoughtfully means you reduce the number of emails going to and fro in your inbox, which would be wonderful.
Okay, then let's get to the dreadful WhatsApp group. There is no language that is appropriate to a WhatsApp group, or is there?
Well, which WhatsApp groups are we talking about?
Okay, pick a WhatsApp group. Let's go there. What is the most complex WhatsApp group you can think of?
Oh, crumbs. I mean, all of the WhatsApp groups I'm on are either friends or sort of school parent concerns, or they tend to be sort of neighborhood watchy type things, which I actually am not a member of, but those are the commonest ones that I see people complaining about.
Do we communicate in different ways in those groups, or do we stick to the same laws, which are keep it short, keep it sweet, keep it simple?
I think those laws remain regardless, but I think we always communicate differently no matter who we're speaking to. That's a sociolinguistic phenomenon. So when you're a teenager, you talk one way to your friends, you talk a different way to the school principal, you talk a different way to your parents. And we all do that unconsciously. We speak very differently to our boss than we do to our colleagues. So again, it's who's reading this? What do they need to know? What do they need to get out of this? Do I need to persuade them of something? Do I need to inform them of something? Do I need to educate them about something? You know, we don't just go in and communicate like a bull in a china shop. Stepping back for 30 seconds and thinking about the message, about the medium, about who needs to get what out of it can make our communication a lot better.
Do we introduce ourselves? Do we go, I mean, if I'm sending you a WhatsApp, and let's assume we've not ever met.
Yes.
Do I go, dear Mandy? Do I go, hi, Mandy? Do I say, good morning, good afternoon, good day, Mandy? Do I go, Mandy, it's Bruce Whitfield.
I think WhatsApp is a little less formal, so you don't need to, you know, for emails, I prefer, in the professional setting, I prefer dear because it's neutral. On a WhatsApp, I would tend to go Yo. Straight into the, no, not quite. I would go straight into the, hi, I'm Mandy Collins, so-and-so referred me to you, and then go straight into the purpose of the message so that you get to the point quickly. People don't have tolerance for scrolling down.
Do you refer to people by their first name in the WhatsApp? Somebody you might refer to, dear Ms. Collins, in an email.
Mm.
Would I refer to you, if I've not ever met you before, as, hi, Ms. Collins. I've been referred to you by Mr. Johnson, and I'm Mr. Whitfield. Or how do we do
this? I think a lot of those honorifics have fallen away. I think if you're worried, use the honorific, and they will say, please call me Mandy or call me Bruce or whatever. I tend to work with a lot of doctors, so I always go in with a doctor, you know, to appease their God complex. And then when they answer and tell, but with their first name, then I take the cue from the way they respond. Yeah. So the guideline Very is always good. To go in slightly more formal, and then when people give you permission to be less formal, then you can be less formal.
In the same way as going to the cocktail party where you've overdressed.
Exactly. Then you can take off your tie if everybody else is in an open-necked shirt.
You wear a tie.
Of course.
Oh, naturally, I would expect nothing less. But the honorifics of the dears and all that sort of stuff are banned, I would argue, in the WhatsApp SMS space.
Yes, I don't think they're necessary there. I think on email, you know, again, depending on your relationship with the person, you know, if you're writing to a professor in a university, you're not going to go, how's it, Brew, when you send him an email. You're going to say, dear Professor so-and-so. And similarly in a WhatsApp, I might actually do it as well. If it's somebody who's got sort of an actual title apart from Mr. or Ms., I'd go with the title because people are a bit touchy about those.
What happens if it's an honorary doctorate?
I'm not going to investigate the entire credential, Bruce. I'm not keeping track.
What happens if they've got an MBA? Do you have to acknowledge their MBA?
No, then you have to use really big words like scaling and lowering the
jargon.
You've got to use lots of jargon if it's an MBA, definitely.
Yes, you have to. And you only know if they've done an MBA if they come back with a jargon filled
Exactly,
rant.
And then you take your cue from that.
How do you sign off from these things? I mean, and in what context do you sign off? I feel quite rude in WhatsApp conversations not signing off sometimes. And I think I've become used to it. But I've stopped signing off on emails. And I kind of feel a bit grubby not signing off on an email.
And so you should. No, I'm kidding.
But it feels incomplete, especially when it's when we're having a conversation by email, like, do you need milk? Yes, I need milk. Okay, I'll get the milk. I'm not going to be signing off, I'll get the milk, regards Bruce, or
yes,
whatever the case might be.
Yes. Well, again, I'm going to sound really repetitive, but you take your cue from who you're talking to, why you're talking to them, what you're talking about. So if you're emailing your wife about buying milk, which I hope is not necessary, then you could probably just go chat later. If it's someone informal, if it's a colleague, for example, you're not going to sign off every email. But if you want to signify that the conversation has now come to an end, you could say something like,
go
cheers.
To hell.
Yes, exactly. That's a very tempting one.
It is. Often.
But you could say chat later or cheers. If you're signing off from the managing director, you might want to say many thanks or regards. I don't like regards really, because are they good regards or bad regards? It's a very neutral term that can go every way, you know, either way. So I think pick something you like that feels good to you, but again, look for tone. So you don't want to say cheers to the person who's just hired you to do a job, for example.
Just brew.
Exactly.
Yeah. And what about emojis? This is a lovely one because
I don't like them.
They have a use. I've come to appreciate their usefulness in some circumstances.
Yes, in some circumstances, particularly if you want to indicate that you're joking and somebody might take something the wrong way. But then I would question whether that joke should really be in the email, especially in a professional setting. So, I mean, that same Hey Babe chick who wrote to me.
You just called the Hey Babe.
She's a chick if she starts an email with Hey Babe.
Okay.
At the end of each line in a professional thing, there was a smiley face. Every single line. It's not appropriate.
How did you respond to that?
The way I respond to most press releases, which is I delete them and ignore them completely.
Excellent. Which is the best way.
She's most of the nonsense.
Have you ever heard of Jim Beglin and Peter Drury?
I have not.
No, nor have I. So somebody who doesn't sign their name, being rude on the SMS line, with all due respect,
don't respect you at all. Carry on.
With all due respect, it should have a comma. With all due respect, just listen to Jim Beglin and Peter Drury of the English Premier League. They use words like confubulate and combobulate. You can't even spell.
They're discombobulated.
I'm discombobulated by your conflation of the English language. Stop it. There is no excuse for that kind of nonsense, is there?
No, there really isn't. And it's people trying to sound more important and more impressive than they are. And some of the most elegant communicators out there use very plain, simple language. And their communication is elegant because you can actually understand it.
The courage to express complex ideas in simple language is one of the most beautiful creations and most beautiful uses of language.
I agree.
I mean, and if you're reading something that is out of your comfort zone, it may be a scientific paper, it could be a paper of mathematics or interior decorating, it doesn't matter what it is, it's outside your comfort zone, and the person who is communicating that subject to you does you the service of communicating it in a way that makes you feel smart, they're the genius.
Absolutely.
Are they not?
Absolutely. And also, for me, it's really about the content. And, you know, you can be interested in most things if the people who are writing or speaking about it are interesting themselves and if they are passionate themselves. And when the language and the writing and the words start to get in the way of that passion and that topic, then I have a problem with it. I don't want to see the writing. I want it to be invisible. And that means it has to be simple, plain, well-executed, accurate, so and then you can actually get to whatever is on the other side, which is the content.
That is so good. The writing should be invisible. Oh, Mandy. Khausa on Twitter wants to know, signing off with kind regards, is that acceptable? No, it's not, Khausa. No, it's not. Best regards, kind regards, worst regards, simplistic regards, elegant regards. No.
You know what? I think kind regards is better than regards because at least we know you feel kindly towards us.
I stand correct.
So I think it's really just, you know, We can sort of browbeat about this and we can, you know, put our head in our hands. And the key is just to be polite. I don't like people starting with good morning, good evening, because what if I read it at a different kind of day? What if I'm having a really terrible day?
Goodbye, Mandy.
Yes, exactly.
No, really, we're out of time. Goodbye, Mandy.
Bye.
Mandy Collins, you're a superstar. Thank you so much for coming in and telling us how to behave better in a digital universe. One day when we get to the fourth industrial revolution, have a listen to this podcast and then you will communicate better with the robots. Mandy Collins, thank you very much.